Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Professor Lawrence Lessig, has spent much of his career trying to fix our broken and corrupt political system. He starts his latest book, America Compromised, with this, quote, "Not a single American awake to the world is comfortable with the way things are," end quote. Well, he's right. The question we ask on almost every show is, what can we do about it? People are organizing, rallying, taking to the streets, running for office. The list is very long. But still, as Lawrence Lessig writes and studies show, politicians are not acting in the interests of their constituents. Oversight bodies have failed to spare consumers from harm, and far too many media outlets pursue horse race stories rather than cover issues that matter. Lawrence Lessig argues that many of these problems are not the result of individual corrupt or evil actors. They are the result of institutional corruption. By scrutinizing our institution through this lens, he argues we could trigger very important conversations about who we are, who we want to be, and what we want to achieve. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was a professor at Stanford Law School, where he founded the school's Center for Internet and Society, and at the University of Chicago. He's also the co-founder of Creative Commons and has written several books. His most recent is America Compromised. Professor Lawrence Lessig, who goes by Larry, joins us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Larry. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's so great to be back. I wish I were there, though.
Well, we wish you were here. I don't even know if you've ever been in studio, but we have you on every time you write a book. So thank you for joining us. And before we dive in and talk about your latest one, you know, I was doing some reading about your career, and you have spent so many years trying to fix the broken political system. I mean, you even ran for office on kind of a no money in politics platform. So just tell us, I mean, what really drives you to do this work?
Well, it was about a decade. It was 11 years ago. And a friend of mine came to me, somebody I'm sure many of your listeners know of, a boy named Aaron Swartz, who was an activist and a computer internet developer and a real genius. And he said to me, you know, why do you think you're going to make any progress in the area I was then working on, which was internet and copyright issues, so long as we have this deeply corrupted Congress? And at first I tried to resist him, and I said, you know, Aaron, it's not my field. And he said, you mean as an academic? And I said, yeah, as an academic, it's not my field. And he says, well, what about as a citizen? Is it your field as a citizen? And it was an extraordinary conversation, because that night he and I decided that I was going to give up what I was working on. That was the last time I wrote a book about the internet. And I was going to take up this fight, and he joined me in that fight. And the question was, like, how do you raise the awareness first about this deeply corrupted political system that had evolved in our society? And then what could you do actually to rally the political support necessary to change it? So it's been more than a decade, and I don't see that we're going to solve this problem in the next year or so, but I'm still committed that this is something we have to solve if we're going to solve anything else.
Well, it's just bringing up Aaron Swartz, it just brings back memories, because we did a lot of shows about the amazing work he did. And I remember I just looked up the documentary, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. Really, what an amazing man. I mean, the young man, but he did such incredible work.
He did. And when he was driven to suicide, it was incredibly difficult for many of us. And, you know, I think I in particular was so deeply affected by that death. And it really forced me to double down on the work he had started me on. And it was really at that moment that I moved beyond just the academic fight and became much more of an activist in this fight, and that continues even now.
Mm. Larry, when you look at where, I should say, how are you thinking about where we are right now? Because every day we do shows about money and politics. I mean, anytime we talk about an issue or a proposition, because now we have the midterms coming up and on the ballot, as usual, there are so many props. We always follow the money. We talk about gerrymandering and how even in November, in order for some Democrats to win House seats, they need a lot of votes because so many districts are still gerrymandered. We talk about voter suppression. Yesterday, Rebecca Solnit was on the show, and she said, based on her research, she believes that about 20 million people are not voting in this country today because of voter suppression. And then, of course, there's corruption, and we'll talk about that. That's the topic of your book and a lot of the lectures you give. But there's just so much. The judges, not only the Supreme Court, but Trump is appointing lifetime judges to lower courts. There's a lot. How are you kind of thinking about what we're dealing with at this moment? How do you talk to your students about all of these issues?
Well, people like to focus on the way in which we're such a divided nation, but I actually think that we're more a bipolar nation. So on the one hand, we are as divided as we've been since the Civil War. We live in our tribes and we can't even understand people from different tribes. And that division manifests itself in the politics of hate that our politicians embrace and push before us and that, most of the commercial media places right before us. But on the other hand, at the same time that we are so divided, we are more united than we've ever been about the deep dysfunction of our republic, of our government. Overwhelming percentage of Americans, in the 85% to 95%, agree about the basic corruption of this government. The government doesn't respond to the people. They agree about the reasons. There's no difference between Democrats and Republicans when you ask them whether it's money in politics that's causing this. People say, absolutely. The politicians are more focused on their donors than they are on the public, and that the political system has become deeply unrepresentative of America. And that unity, that common ground, is, I think, an enormous opportunity. But the problem we have is the political parties and our politicians are so inept in leveraging common ground. They're so good at leveraging difference and hatred. And so I think the real challenge is to find a way to unify, get people to recognize that though we differ on really important issues, we do have this common view that if we could resolve and we could actually get us a government that represented us equally, we could make enormous progress in getting a government that could govern again. But I'm worried that we don't have that mechanism because we don't have a political system that has any reason to leverage it.
And to your point, you quote a study by Martin Gillens and Ben Page, who wrote the book Democracy in America, What Has Gone Wrong and What Can We Do About It? And you write that they have conducted perhaps the largest empirical study of actual decisions by our government in the history of political science, relating those decisions to the attitudes of the economic elite, organized interest groups, and the average voters. And what they found was that while the actual decisions of our government correlate well with attitudes of the economic elite and with the policies of organized interest groups, they have no correlation with the views of the average voter.
Yeah, in a democracy. I think their study was maybe the most damning that I had seen. But it confirmed what many people have observed about different facets of our democracy. So you went through some of them. But what I think is important is to recognize what links these different problems. And what I think links them is the basic unrepresentativeness of the institutions of our representative government. So, money in politics is the most obvious. I'm sure we're going to spend a long time talking about that. But in a world where Congress people spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money, but raising money from no more than 100,000 Americans, obviously that produces an unrepresentative representative class because they are so focused on what that 100,000 care about and not what the rest of America cares about. But the same thing about gerrymandering. Gerrymandering produces congresspeople who are obsessed about the even more extreme version of their own party. That's the only threat that they have. They're not going to be in a Republican, safe seat Republican district. A Democrat's not going to beat the Republican, but maybe an even further to the right Republican will. Or in a safe seat Democratic district, you're not going to be beaten by a Republican, but an even more progressive Democrat might. So this focuses them, again, not on the average American, but focuses them on the extremes. Or the way we elect our president. We're involved in a I'm involved in a lawsuit right now in California and in Massachusetts and in Texas and South Carolina challenging winner-take-all in the Electoral College. Because what that system does is it focuses the president on just 14 battleground states. In 2016, 99% of spending was in 14 states, which means that the president doesn't care about the states that are not in those 14, and we can show that actually spending and regulations bend to the interests of those 14 states. Even those states representing just 35% of America are older, they're whiter, their industry is not 21st century industry. They are unrepresentative, yet our representative democracy focuses on them rather than the rest of us. And then you mentioned this, but I think this is critical. Our institutions of voter suppression, the way in which we make it harder for some people to vote than for others, produces a democracy that doesn't represent us equally because we don't have an equal freedom to vote. All of these are ways in which we get rendered unequally. And what that means is we have a government that's not interested in responding, as the guy, the Gillens and Page book makes clear, not interested in responding to the representative American. They're interested in responding to the extremes or to the special interests that have this power.
Tell us more about this lawsuit, and listeners can find more about this at the website equalvotes.us. It's equalvotes.us. And there's a video of you explaining the lawsuit, and it says, in a democracy, all votes should count equally. In our democracy, when voting for the president, they do not. Tell us more about this.
Well, you know, in most states, in fact, 48 out of 51 jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, the electoral college votes that the Constitution allocates to the states get allocated on a winner-take-all basis, which means that the winner of the popular vote in the state gets all of the electoral college votes. So if you're a Republican in California, what you know that means is that it doesn't matter if you vote or not, because no matter what happens, you know, California is a solidly Democratic state, and that means every single elector from California is going to go for the Democrats. If you're a Democrat in Texas, what you know is it doesn't matter if you vote, because every single elector in Texas is going to go for the Republican. And that's because of winner-take-all. Now, people, you know, what that technically does is it discounts the votes of the minority voter in the state. So a Republican in California, a Democrat in Texas, it basically counts their votes for the purpose of throwing them away. So we think it violates the principle of equality. But stepping beyond the kind of constitutional principles of equality and just looking what it does to our political system, what we can see is that it makes the candidates care not about America as a whole, but care about these few states that will actually potentially flip from one side to the other. So it distorts the democracy in an obvious and predictable way, and not just in the, you know, increasingly frequent times where we happen to elect the candidate who got the fewer number of votes, like Donald Trump in 2016 or George Bush in 2000. But in every single election, it elects a candidate who's not thinking about, you know, everybody across the country, but thinking about these people who happen to come from these swing states. Now, people sometimes say, well, that's what the framers intended. They intended a system of the Electoral College that would give the small states special power. But the swing states are not small states. You know, Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, these are not small states. They are just purple states. They are states where the number of voters in the Republican side is very close to the number of voters in the Democratic side, which makes them gettable by other sides. So it's not anything to do with what our Constitution was intended to support. It doesn't actually give us a democratic process that is representative. There is no good reason for it, except this just happens to be the way things have developed. So we've brought a lawsuit. David Boies is our lead attorney, and we're asking the court to test this system against the principles of a democracy where everybody's vote should matter equally and not allow the states to adopt systems for counting the votes, which basically discard every vote except for the votes of winners.
And the numbers are pretty amazing. On the website, you show that in 2016, 3.8 million Texans voted for Hillary Clinton for president, but that translated into zero electoral college votes. Here in California, 4.4 million people voted for Trump, translated into zero electoral college votes.
Right. And you know, and many people are, you know, obsessed with trying to figure out, well, what would have happened if we had, like, allocated the votes proportionally the way we think the Constitution requires in 2016. But I think the really important thing to recognize is that if you are allocating the votes proportionally, as we've asked the court to declare the Constitution requires, presidential campaigns would be radically different. Like, right now, no presidential candidate has any reason to listen to the voters in California. No Democrat does, because the Democrat knows he or she's going to win regardless. No Republican does, because regardless of what the Republicans do, they're never going to get enough votes to matter in California. So that means California is irrelevant. And it's irrelevant in many ways, but we saw this directly, you know, after Trump was elected and he announced the end of the offshore drilling ban. Almost overnight, Florida got an exemption from that ending of the offshore drilling ban. California couldn't even get a hearing, and the reason between the reason for the difference between the two is that Florida is a swing state, and Donald Trump needs Florida in 2020, and California is irrelevant to Donald Trump's reelection campaign. So the views of Californians just don't matter.
We're just a piggy bank, really, for politicians.
Yes, that's why they go there, for the money, and that's the only reason they go there.
Today we're speaking with Lawrence Lessig, Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. He is the author of many books. His latest is America Compromised, and it begins with this sentence: not a single American awake to the world is comfortable with the way things are. Larry has dedicated much of his career trying to fix the broken and corrupt political system. And if you have any questions or comments, maybe about this one person, one vote lawsuit, or about the broken and corrupt political system, on almost every single show we talk about this and what we can do to change things. So what are your thoughts about where we are today and the changes that you would like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Larry, just quickly back to this lawsuit. What's the status of this suit? These suits.
Well,
I should
say. We filed in four states, and the district court in two states has now had hearings. So in California, there was a hearing at the end of July, and then in Massachusetts in the beginning of August, and we're waiting for the opinions from those hearings. The assumption is that out of the four separate circuits that we are bringing these cases, one in Texas, one in California, one in Massachusetts, one in South Carolina, at least one of the circuit courts will agree with us. And if that happens, then we will be in the Supreme Court. And interestingly, most likely, given the state of the law in the circuits right now, it's in the Fourth Circuit, where there was recently a case in North Carolina striking down the political gerrymandering that the North Carolina legislature had engaged in. And the principle of that decision was the First Amendment. And we have argued from the very beginning that the First Amendment is another reason why winner-take-all violates the Constitution. And so we think that there's a very good chance out of North Carolina, out of that decision, we will get a victory in the Fourth Circuit. And if there's just one circuit, it will get up to the Supreme Court without a doubt.
Well, I mean, you have a lot of experience with judges, and I wonder, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? Brett Kavanaugh is most likely going to be confirmed at the Supreme Court. What's not getting as much attention, we've been talking about this, are all of the federal judges that Trump is appointing. These are lifetime appointments, a lot of very conservative people. The Washington Post had a piece a couple weeks ago called Trump Federal Judges, How GOP is Remaking the Courts.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And, of course, the Senate has been very quick to confirm the Trump appointees, when they were very slow to confirm the Obama appointees, and indeed with Obama's appointment to the Supreme Court refused even to have a hearing, and that same principle is now being ignored in the context of this recent appointment of Brett Kavanaugh. I do think the courts are certainly going to be much more conservative going forward. But, you know, I'm a liberal who clerked for Justice Scalia. And what I learned in that experience is that politics doesn't predict every dimension of the important questions of constitutional law. And so whereas, you know, I wouldn't want to be a Democrat running among judges for any office because I'm sure they would vote Republican, I do think there are many important questions where you can appeal to the interest of the principles that they advance. So we, in the Equal Citizens, the organization that I started to fight these issues, we've got a lawsuit that we have filed in Alaska challenging super PACs. And we basically, there's a weird provision in Alaskan law that allows citizens in Alaska to complain when their election law is not being enforced. And in Alaska, there was a super PAC law. It was not being enforced. So a bunch of citizens complained. And the election commission said, we can't enforce it because super PACs have been declared protected by the First Amendment. And so we then said, well, actually, if you were an originalist, meaning one of these conservatives, like, you know, it's not clear so much whether Brett Kavanaugh thinks of himself precisely in this way, but Gorsuch certainly does. If you were an originalist, the scholarship about our framers is that it's perfectly clear, I talk about this in the book, that they would have viewed something like super PACs as a corruption of the institution of democracy, not the corruption of individuals, but a corruption of the institution. So consistent with your principles, your originalist principles, you should allow legislatures to regulate things like super PACs. Now, I don't believe we're going to win necessarily in Alaska or in the Alaska Supreme Court when we appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. But I do believe we'll have a clear shot to the United States Supreme Court, where four liberal justices or less than conservative justices will be eager to have this case heard. And we'll be making an argument directly to, you know, the justices like Justice Gorsuch, who wants to be an originalist, who shows that originalism doesn't necessarily mean doing what conservatives want. And, you know, it's an outside chance, but there is a chance that they do the right thing, uphold a principle against corruption, which super PACs clearly are, and affirm the opportunity of legislatures to themselves from the corrupting influence of that huge source of money.
And just quickly, we're almost to a break. You write in your book, America Compromised, as of February 2016, the top 50 super PAC contributors had given nearly half of the money received by all super PACs.
Yeah, by the candidates running for president, right, in the super PACs running. That's exactly right. And the concentration is just increasing. And candidates focus their attention. This is why it's a corruption. They focus their attention on making the super PACs happy. Well, you know, in a democracy, you're supposed to focus your attention on making the voters happy. It's the voters whose interests they are to be responding to. But the system, the institution has been corrupted so that they're more interested in making the money happy and then secondarily interested in making the voters happy.
Today we are speaking with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He is the author of many books about our broken and corrupt political system. He also includes many solutions. We'll talk about those after the break. Lawrence Lessig's latest book is called America Compromised. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Lawrence Lessig has spent much of his career trying to fix our broken and corrupt political system. He's out with a new book called America Compromised. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Larry, I'd like to talk with you about media coverage. You know, I have to say, when I hear reporters and pundits say that our system is broken, I get kind of angry because it's such a simplistic statement. And if you look at how we got here, I mean, there are reasons. When you look at, for example, voter suppression, Republicans are passing so many voter ID laws and a number of voter suppression laws across the country. Gerrymandering. We've had Dave Daley on talking about his excellent book called Rat Effed. And he said, sure, the Democrats definitely gerrymander, but they know there's a limit. The Republicans go so extremely far, there's no limit for them. And the Dems really got blindsided by the technology that the Republicans used. So there's that issue. And then when you look at Merrick Garland, I mean, that would never happen if a Republican appointed someone to the Supreme Court and the Democrats tried to block it. No way. The Republicans are so much better at doing these kinds of things. I mean, so what are your thoughts about that? Because our system is broken is such a simplistic statement without context, and yet we hear it all the time.
That's true. And, you know, as a Democrat, I'd be happy to go on and on and on about how crazy I think the other party is. But I actually think we're at a moment in American history when we have to find a way to rise above that partisan division. So, yeah, they're both. Yes, you're right. I think if you had to say which was the more extreme, I'd vote the Republicans. But it's not as if the Democrats are innocent in this story. So the Democrats didn't gerrymander as in 2010 as well as the Republicans did. But they certainly gerrymander. And the Democrats did not succeed in 2010 to pass reform to the way we fund campaigns. But, you know, it's not because they tried very hard to do it either. And so I think with each of these issues, the important thing to recognize is the way the politicians within the political system have allowed the system itself to be corrupted. Right. And we as citizens need to find a way to rise to demand that they fix that system, not on behalf of the Democratic Party, but on behalf of citizens, Americans,
right.
So that we get a republic that actually is responsive to all of us.
I think it's so right. You know, for example, Nancy Pelosi is the representative of San Francisco. A lot of people, I mean, she rarely comes to San Francisco to do town halls, but she's constantly flying back and forth to raise money for Democrats.
Yeah, she's the leading, most successful fundraiser for the Democratic Party. I have a lot of respect for her because I think she has evolved significantly on this issue. There was a great, it's an amazing interview she did with John Stewart, probably in 2013, where John Stewart was saying, you know, the system is corrupt. And Nancy Pelosi was saying, no, the system's not corrupt. There are corrupt people in the system, but the system is not corrupt. And it kind of triggered John Stewart. He went crazy. He could not believe she was saying that. But she has now, I think, taken a very strong position in Congress about the need for fundamental reform. And she has promised that if the Democrats are in control of Congress, the very first thing they will do will be to bring a package of reforms to the floor of the House, which include citizen funding of congressional elections, I think the most important of these reforms, because I think she has come to recognize that the current system produces a government that can't do anything, especially the things that Democrats want it to do, because the representatives are so vulnerable to the money. So, you know, people forget this, but actually the slogan "drain the swamp" was Nancy Pelosi's slogan before Donald Trump stole it. So here is an opportunity. Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi agree about something. So why can't we leverage that into real effective change?
You know, I was thinking about Citizens United, and Hillary Clinton in July of 2016 pledged to a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. What were you hearing in D.C.? Do you think that would have been possible?
Well, you know, actually, I think Hillary Clinton had in her platform the most aggressive reform package of anybody, far more than even Bernie Sanders. I think the problem was people didn't believe she really cared about it. So, you know, it's not just that she talked about overturning Citizens United, which, you know, I think that's kind of cheap talk because it's so hard to imagine a constitutional amendment that it's easy to talk about your support for it, knowing it will never come to pass. She not only talked about that, more important to me, she talked about the need to have citizen funding of congressional elections so that you don't have congressmen spending 30 to 70% of their time sucking up to less than 100,000 Americans. That's the change that would liberate Congress to begin to think about Americans again, as opposed to thinking about the funders of campaigns. And I thought her platform was better than anybody's in endorsing and pressing that idea, if only America had believed that she really cared enough to make it happen.
Today we're speaking with Lawrence Lessig about his latest book, America Compromised. And let's hear from a few listeners. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and good morning, Mr. Lessing. Thank you so much for your good work. I disagree with Rose that the Republicans do it these misdeeds better than the Democrats. The Democrats have been at it for a long time as well. I could get into details, but my main reason for calling is to ask whether or not Mr. Lessing has gained any conservative support for his efforts, which seem to be bipartisan. In particular, I was wondering whether Ted Olson, who worked with Mr. Boies on the same-sex marriage issue, might be interested in joining your efforts.
Well, so I'm actually litigating against Ted Olson in a case. I'm defending the city of Berkeley against Ted Olson. And so we've become, he's an extraordinary lawyer, and we've become friends. He's not yet joined the cause of this reform. But there are many conservative and Republicans who are deeply committed to reform. There's a great group out there called Take Back Our Republic. And they have an extraordinary list of conservatives who stepped up and begun to talk about precisely these kinds of changes, including, one of their founders was Richard Painter, who was the ethics czar for George Bush, who published this fantastic book called No Representation, No Taxation Without Representation, which calls for public funding of congressional elections. Because he believes that's the only way to get a Congress that actually cares about the people as opposed to their funders. So I don't see this. I completely agree with the caller. I don't see this as an issue where the right has to oppose the left. I think the polls show and people show that everybody thinks this is a corrupted system, and we just have to build the political will to step above our divisions to actually address it effectively.
Well, thank you for calling, John. Let's go next to Mark in San Jose. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to hear you folks talk about this. I think I would suggest there's a couple of things that we need to look at. The idea of apportioning the votes for the Electoral College had a couple of problems. Number one, the person in Wyoming still has more of a single vote than I do in that system in California, dramatically more. And so that doesn't solve that problem. And it really continues the gentleman said, Professor Lessig said, since the Civil War and since the founding of the Republic. I mean, slavery was protected for, 50 years in the Republic? The Congress couldn't touch slavery. I think it was 50 years. The whole three-fifths apportionment for slaves fed into the House of Representatives, and it fed into the Electoral College by definition. And then the disproportionality of the Senate. So I think we really need to step back. I think also the public funding of congressional races would be great, except for I think Buckley v. Villea would say that if I opted out of that, I could spend as much money of my own as I wanted to under existing precedent, and the court's not going to get any more liberal. I think we really have to start looking at constitutional amendments, and the way I would propose to do it is say eliminate the Electoral College first, because we have two horrible presidencies, two wars, and whatever you want to call the disaster we're in now because of it, and arguably, and then I think Congress needs to get this package of reforms put together, but then they have to be willing to come and do another quick vote as soon as the Supreme Court annuls any of those provisions, because they're going to have to do that with this court with five votes. I don't see any movement there, and it's more likely that more of the left-leaning justices will go before anybody else. I also
All right, Mark, let's get a response from Larry. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and I think I agree with most of it. So you're right. It's certainly true that if you allocated electoral votes proportionally in each state, which is what we're asking for in our litigation, the small states would still have an advantage over the big states. It wouldn't be anywhere as distortive as the current system is, because, again, the current system concentrates the elections in just 14 states. If you had proportional allocation of all the electoral votes, then candidates would have a reason to be campaigning in every single state. Now, without abolishing the Electoral College, another proposal that's out there, and I personally, independent of litigation, support this proposal, is something called the National Popular Vote Compact, which is basically states promise that when the equivalent of 270 electoral votes have been pledged, they will tell their electors to vote for the winner of the national popular vote. So that project is about 100 electors away from achieving its number of 270. And if it achieved that number, what that would mean is the winner of the national popular vote would automatically win the presidency regardless of how that broke down in each particular state. I support that individually. We could achieve that tomorrow if without a constitutional amendment. And I think that would, again, radically change the nature of the way presidents run, because they would be interested in running everywhere in the country, not just in those areas that happen to be battleground states.
Well, thank you for the call, Mark. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Professor Lawrence Lessig, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Lawrence Lessig has spent many, many years writing about and speaking about our broken and corrupt political system and how to fix it. His latest book is called America Compromised. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk a bit about the media, because the media plays such an important role when it comes to all of these issues. You track how the internet really changed the way news is delivered and consumed. And you looked specifically at the way news outlets are affected by competition for attention. What really stands out for you? What did you find?
Well, you know, I remember way back in the birth of the internet, when we talked about how great the internet was going to be, you know, we would talk about the internet eliminating all censors. But another way to describe that is that the internet would eliminate all editors. And, you know, editors perform a really important function, which is the judgment about, you know, what topics we ought to be talking about and what topics merit time and which don't. And I think one of the things this last election demonstrated was that nobody had the ability to control to steer the conversation in directions that everybody would believe it made sense to address. So, you know, the studies about the focus on the so-called email scandal demonstrate that was the number one issue people talked about, and by people I mean journalists, news outlets, by far. Even though, you know, there was not, in my view, no quote scandal, there was no illegality at the time that Hillary Clinton did what she did with the emails at all, and that nobody could afford, nobody could steer the conversation anywhere else, because they realized that this is just something that people wanted to hear about, and so people got what they wanted to hear. And that dynamic, I think, is something we don't yet know how to respond to, because if the public needs to understand a range of issues to decide who the best candidate is, we have to have a way to deliver those issues, that information, to the public so that they have the basis for making this judgment. And 2016 doesn't give you much confidence that we have discovered that technology yet.
The New York Times is getting a lot of praise for the breaking stories about the latest scandal in the White House. And the Columbia Journalism Review found that in just 6 days, the New York Times ran as many cover stories about Hillary Clinton's emails as they did about all of the policy issues combined in the 69 days leading up to the election. And these are above the fold stories.
Yeah, and this is exactly the dynamic. New York Times is a perfect target to make this clear. You know, the New York Times recognize that all these other outlets like Breitbart and Fox News were paying an extraordinary amount of attention to these email questions. And in a certain way, they felt like they had to cover them themselves, because if they didn't, they would seem to be partisan or biased in favor of Hillary Clinton. So the fact that the others, in a very strategic way, were raising this issue drove the New York Times to do what I'm sure, in their better judgment, they knew they should not be doing. They should be covering foreign affairs, or they should be covering, you know, the nature of the economic recoveries being promised by either a candidate. But they couldn't afford to do it because they were constrained in this incredibly competitive environment to be covering what the other people were covering too. And that dynamic, I don't think we have any obvious or easy way to escape right now.
And as you point out, I mean, and we talked about this so much, Donald Trump was given more than $2 billion worth of free TV time during the election, while Bernie Sanders received $350 million worth. This was by about February 2016. But this was a massive moneymaker for the media. Les Moonves, the very well-paid CEO of CBS, who just stepped down after six more women raised new assault and harassment claims, a lot of great reporting by Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker. Les Moonves, in 2016, at an investor conference, told people, you know, this is great for CBS. It might be a terrible thing for the country, but bring it on, Donald. Keep it going.
Yeah. I think that, you know, people are increasingly questioning the business model of media as it relates to the business model of politics. You know, I think we should be clear. I think some media is relatively immune from this business model. I think, you know, public media is an incredibly important part of the ecology of media in America right now. And people are increasingly looking to public media because they believe it to be relatively insulated from this commercial dynamic. But, you know, if you look at Fox News and CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, both of them have understood that they've got a very high market return from being as you know, playing the politics of hate. And that's what they love to play. And Donald Trump, to the extent that he fuels this by his extremism, you know, helps them. So it's not obvious that the current business model of commercial media is actually constructive for the democracy. And this really urgently drives us to think about what other ways of producing media or information could we complement the current system with, so that we have a public who knows what they're talking about when they go out there and they vote.
Hmm. Today we're joined by Lawrence Lessig. He is the author of many books about our political system, about money and politics, about how we vote. His latest book is called America Compromised. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Nick in Oakland. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So I had a follow-up question from what a caller earlier had asked about, who had asked about support, you know, conservative support for these kind of campaign finance reforms. And your guest mentioned that the polls show that there is a lot of support from the actual voters and the people on both the right and left for this issue. But there doesn't appear to be any from the actual politicians. So my question is, you know, how do we get the change on the right from the actual politicians when their constituents already want this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's important to remember the dynamic at the, you know, in the fall of 2015 in the Republican Party, when Donald Trump was first coming to the fore of the endless list of those campaigns. Donald Trump, from the very beginning, called out those other candidates on the basis of money. Donald Trump said, you know, all of these people are owned. I know so because, you know, he said, I used to give them money, and I know how they behave when they take the money. And that argument that they were all corrupted by the money and Donald Trump was not, even though it was completely false. I mean, he said he was going to fund his own campaign. He didn't. He took money from all sorts of people. But the perception at that time was that he was genuine, that he was going to fund his own campaign. He was going to be independent of the big money. That message really resonated on the right. And then Donald Trump took it a step further, and he called out super PACs, and he said super PACs were an abomination, that he thinks they need to be banned, that they were corrupting the political process. He attacked Bush by saying that Bush, you know, was constantly focused on what his big contributors would be doing and Donald Trump wouldn't, and that was because of super PACs. And when he did that, I was incredibly hopeful because for the first time, a major Republican leader was putting money at the center of the fight. Now, you know, John McCain had done the same thing in 2000 when he ran as the, quote, maverick, and he eventually became the key behind the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill. But I think that Donald Trump opened the field up. Now, you know, the reality is he's done nothing to deliver on that promise. He said he would drain the swamp. The swamp is vibrant and very much alive in Washington right now. But I think that he pointed to a latent desire among even Republicans. And I would be very surprised if you don't see others beginning to pick that up as well. And that's what we've got to leverage, this common ground about the corruption of money in our political system, and find a way to actually turn it into real policy change.
Well, thank you, Nick. And as you write again, Larry, not a single American awake to the world is comfortable with the way things are. And given all the books that you've written, the talks that you've given, the people that you meet on the road, because you have, you've done this amazing march to take money out of politics, and that was a couple years ago, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? Because there's so much activity, so much grassroots activism. I mean, people who are running for office, you know, are beating Democratic incumbents. It's kind of amazing to see with very little money and just they're doing it with grassroots activism. What are your thoughts about where we are? And at this point, what do you think is most effective?
Well, it feels like, to use a cliche, the best of times and the worst of times. It's the best of times for reform because I genuinely believe, you know, America is there. And across the spectrum, America is there. And the frustration is palpable. And the opportunity for politicians to tap it has never been as available. But on the other hand, I fear that the politicians are so embedded in their politics of hate, the partisanship of how modern American politics works, that we'll miss the opportunity to leverage this incredible unity of views. So, you know, as a progressive myself, you can't help but be excited when people, you know, with almost no money are able to oust, you know, traditional Democrats in the name of, you know, real ideas that are exciting and would make America a much more vibrant democracy. But on the other hand, you know, if you want to go and talk about single-payer health care, but you're not willing to talk about changing the corrupt way we fund campaigns, then you're just not serious. We're never going to get single-payer health care in a world where insurance companies and doctors and pharmaceutical companies are funding campaigns. It just will not happen. So if we're going to be credible, especially the progressives, about the reforms that we're pushing, we've got to put at the very front the idea that we change the corruption of this democracy so that we have a democracy that can respond to the people. And if we made that the focus, I think we would attract not just the progressives. I think we would attract many Americans who are just so frustrated and angry with the system the way it has evolved.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School, the author of many books. His latest is America Compromised. Larry, as always, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us. And next time you're in San Francisco, we'd love to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Rose.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.